This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents No Longer Human by Osamu Dazai. Translated by Donald Keane. Narrated by David Shi. Translator's Introduction. I think that Osamu Dazai would have been gratified by the reviews his novel, The Setting Sun, received when the English translation was published in the United States. Even though some of the critics were distressed by the picture the book drew of contemporary Japan, they, one and all, discussed it in the terms reserved for works of importance. There was no trace of the condescension often bestowed on writings emanating from remote parts of the world. And for once, nobody thought to use the damning adjective exquisite about an unquestionably Japanese product. It was judged among its peers, the moving and beautiful books of the present generation. One aspect of The Setting Sun puzzled many readers, however, and may puzzle others in Dazai's second novel, No Longer Human, the role of Western culture in Japanese life today. Like Yozo, the chief figure of No Longer Human, Dazai grew up in a small town in the remote north of Japan, and we might have expected his novels to be marked by the simplicity, love of nature, and purity of sentiments of the inhabitants of such a place. However, Dazai's family was rich and educated, and from his childhood days, he was familiar with European literature, American movies, reproductions of modern paintings and sculpture, and much else of our civilization. These became such important parts of his own experience that he could not help being influenced by them, and he mentioned them quite as freely as might any author in Europe or America. In reading his works, however, we are sometimes made aware that Dazai's understanding or use of these elements of the West is not always the same as ours. It is easy to conclude from this that Dazai had only half digested them, or even that the Japanese as a whole have somehow misappropriated our culture. I confess that I find this parochialism curious in the United States. Here, where our suburbs are jammed with a variety of architecture which bears no relation to the antecedents of either the builders or the dwellers, where white people sing Negro spirituals, and a Negro soprano sings Lucia di Lammermoor at the Metropolitan Opera, where our celebrated national dishes, the Frankfurter, the hamburger, and chow mein, betray by their very names non-American origins, can we with honesty rebuke the Japanese for a lack of purity in their modern culture? And can we criticize them for borrowing from us when we are almost as conspicuously in their debt? We find it normal that we drink tea, their beverage, but curious that they should drink whiskey, ours. Our professional decorators, without thinking to impart to us an adequate background in Japanese aesthetics, decree that we should brighten our rooms with Buddhist statuary or with lamps in the shapes of paper lanterns, yet we are apt to find it incongruous if a Japanese ornaments his room with examples of Christian religious art or a lamp of Venetian glass. Why does it seem so strange that another country should have a culture as conglomerate as our own? There are, it is true, works of recent Japanese literature which are relatively untouched by Western influence. Some of them are splendidly written and convince us that we are getting from them what is most typically Japanese in modern fiction. If, however, we do not wish to resemble the Frenchman who finds the detective story the only worthwhile part of American literature, we must also be willing to read Japanese novels in which a modern, by modern I mean Western, intelligence is at work. A writer with such an intelligence, Dazai was one, may also be attracted to the Japanese traditional culture, but it will virtually be with the eyes of a foreigner who finds it appealing but remote. Dostoevsky and Proust are much closer to him than any Japanese writer of, say, the 18th century. Yet we should be unfair to consider such a writer a cultural déraciné. He is not much farther removed from his 18th century, after all, than we are from ours. In his case, to be sure, a foreign culture has intervened, but that culture is now in its third generation in Japan. No Japanese thinks of his business suit as an outlandish or affected garb. It is not only what he normally wears, but was probably also the costume of his father and grandfather before him. To wear Japanese garments would actually be strange and uncomfortable for most men. The majority of Japanese today wear modern Western culture also as they wear their clothes, and to keep reminding them that their ancestors originally attired themselves otherwise is at once bad manners and foolish. It may be wondered at the same time if the Japanese knowledge of the West is more than a set of clothes, however long or well-tailored. Only a psychologist could properly attempt to answer so complex a question, although innumerable casual visitors to Japan have readily opined that under the foreign exterior, the Japanese remain entirely unlike ourselves. I find this view hard to accept. It is true that the Japanese of today differ from Americans, perhaps not more, however, than do Greeks or Portuguese. But they are certainly much more like Americans than they are like their ancestors of 100 years ago. As far as literature is concerned, the break with the Japanese past is almost complete. In Japanese universities today, the Japanese literature department is invariably one of the smallest and least supported. The bright young men generally devote themselves to a study of Western institutions or literature, and the academic journals are filled with learned articles on the symbolism of Le Comte de Lisle, or on the correspondence of James Knox Polk. The fact that these articles will never be read abroad, not even by specialists in Le Comte de Lisle or James Knox Polk, inevitably creates a sense of isolation and even loneliness among intellectuals. Some Japanese of late have taken to referring to themselves as the orphans of Asia, indicating, and perhaps lamenting, the fact that, although Japan has become isolated from the rest of Asia, the Western nations do not accept her literature or learning as part of their own. The Japanese writers of today are cut off from Asian literature as completely as the United States is from Latin American literature, by the conviction that there is nothing to learn. This attitude may be mistaken, but I remember how shocked a Japanese novelist, a friend of mine, was to see his own name included on a list of Lebanese, Iraqi, Burmese, and miscellaneous other Asian writers who had been sponsored by an American foundation. He would undoubtedly have preferred to figure at the tail end of a list of Western writers, or of world writers in general, than to be classed with such obscure exotics. We might like to reprimand the Japanese for the neglect of their own traditional culture, or to insist that Japanese writers should be proud to be associated with other Asians. But such advice comes too late. As the result of our repeated and forcible intrusions in the past, Western tastes are coming to dominate letters everywhere. The most we have reason to expect in the future are world variants of a single literature, of the kind which already exists nationally in Europe. No Longer Human is almost symbolic of the predicament of the Japanese writers today. It is the story of a man who is orphaned from his fellows by the refusal to take him seriously. He is denied the love of his father, taken advantage of by his friends, and finally, in turn, is cruel to the women who love him. He does not insist, because of his experiences, that the others are all wrong, and he alone right. On the contrary, he records with devastating honesty his every transgression of a code of human conduct which he cannot fathom. Yet, As Dazai realized, if the eye of the novel did not, the cowardly acts and moments of abject collapse do not tell the whole story. In a superb epilogue, the only objective witness testifies, he was an angel. And we are suddenly made to realize the incompleteness of Yozo's portrait of himself. In the way that most men fail to see their own cruelty, Yozo had not noticed his gentleness and his capacity for love. Yozo's experiences are certainly not typical of all Japanese intellectuals, but the sense of isolation which they feel between themselves and the rest of the world is perhaps akin to Yozo's conviction that he alone is not human. Again, his frustrations at the university, his unhappy involvement with the Communist Party, his disastrous love affairs, all belong to the past of many writers of today. At the same time, detail after detail clearly is derived from the individual experience of Osamu Dazai himself. The temptation is strong to consider the book as a barely fictionalized autobiography, but this would be a mistake, I am sure. Dazai had the creative artistry of a great cameraman. His lens is often trained on moments of his own past, but thanks to his brilliant skill in composition and selection, his photographs are not what we expect to find cluttering an album. There is nothing of the meandering reminiscer about Dazai. With him, all is sharp, brief, and evocative. Even if each scene of No Longer Human were the exact reproduction of an incident from Dazai's life, of course, this is not the case, his technique would qualify the whole of the work as one of original fiction. No Longer Human is not a cheerful book, yet its effect is far from that of a painful wound gratuitously inflicted on the reader. As a reviewer, Richard Gilman in Jubilee wrote of Dazai's earlier novel, "Such is the power of art, to transfigure what is objectively ignoble or depraved, that the setting sun is actually deeply moving and even inspiriting. To know the nature of despair and to triumph over it in the ways that are possible to oneself, imagination was Dazai's only weapon, is surely a sort of grace." Donald Keen. Prologue. I have seen three pictures of the man. The first, a childhood photograph, you might call it, shows him about the age of 10. A small boy surrounded by a great many women, his sisters and cousins, no doubt. He stands in brightly checked trousers by the edge of a garden pond. His head is tilted at an angle 30 degrees to the left, and his teeth are bared in an ugly smirk. Ugly? You may well question the word, for insensitive people, that is to say, those indifferent to matters of beauty and ugliness, would mechanically comment with a bland, vacuous expression, "What an adorable little boy!" It is quite true that what commonly passes for adorable is sufficiently present in this child's face to give a modicum of meaning to the compliment. But I think that anyone who had ever been subjected to the least exposure to what makes for beauty would most likely toss the photograph to one side with the gesture employed in brushing away a caterpillar and mutter in profound revulsion, "What a dreadful child!" Indeed, the more carefully you examine the child's smiling face, the more you feel an indescribable, unspeakable horror creeping over you. You see that it is actually not a smiling face at all. The boy has not a suggestion of a smile. Look at his tightly clenched fists if you want proof. No human being can smile with his fist doubled like that. It is a monkey. A grinning monkey face. The smile is nothing more than a puckering of ugly wrinkles. The photograph reproduces an expression so freakish and at the same time so unclean and even nauseating that your impulse is to say, "What a wizened, hideous little boy. I have never seen a child with such an unaccountable expression." The face in the second snapshot is startlingly unlike the first. He is a student in this picture, although it is not clear whether it dates from high school or college days. At any rate, he is now extraordinarily handsome. But here again, the face fails inexplicably to give the impression of belonging to a living human being. He wears a student's uniform, and a white handkerchief peeps from his breast pocket. He sits in a wicker chair with his legs crossed. Again, he is smiling. This time, not the wizened monkey's grin, but a rather adroit little smile. And yet somehow, it is not the smile of a human being. It utterly lacks substance, all of what we might call the heaviness of blood, or perhaps the solidity of human life. It is not even a bird's weight. It is merely a blank sheet of paper, light as a feather, and it is smiling. The picture produces, in short, a sensation of complete artificiality, pretense, insincerity, fatuousness. None of these words quite covers it. And of course, you couldn't dismiss it simply as dandyism. In fact, if you look carefully, you will begin to feel that there is something strangely unpleasant about this handsome young man. I have never seen a young man whose good looks were so baffling. The remaining photograph is the most monstrous of all. It is quite impossible in this one even to guess the age, though the hair seems to be streaked somewhat with gray. It was taken in a corner of an extraordinarily dirty room. You can plainly see in the picture how the wall is crumbling in three places. His small hands are held in front of him. This time, he is not smiling. There is no expression whatsoever. The picture has a genuinely chilling, foreboding quality, as if it caught him in the act of dying as he sat before the camera, his hands held over a heater. That is not the only shocking thing about it. The head is shown quite large, and you can examine the features in detail. The forehead is average. The wrinkles on the forehead average. The eyebrows also average. The eyes, the nose, the mouth, the chin. The face is not merely devoid of expression. It fails even to leave a memory. It has no individuality. I have only to shut my eyes after looking at it to forget the face. I can remember the wall of the room, the little heater, but all impression of the face of the principal figure in the room is blotted out. I am unable to recall a single thing about it. This face could never be made the subject of a painting, not even of a cartoon. I open my eyes. There is not even the pleasure of recollecting. Of course, that's the kind of face it was. To state the matter in the most extreme terms, when I open my eyes and look at the photograph a second time, I still cannot remember it. Besides, it rubs against me the wrong way and makes me feel so uncomfortable that in the end, I want to avert my eyes. I think that even a death mask would hold more of an expression, leave more of a memory. That effigy suggests nothing so much as a human body to which a horse's head has been attached. Something ineffable makes the beholder shudder in distaste. I have never seen such an inscrutable face on a man. The First Notebook. Mine has been a life of much shame. I can't even guess myself what it must be to live the life of a human being. I was born in a village in the Northeast, and it wasn't until I was quite big that I saw my first train. I climbed up and down the station bridge, quite unaware that its function was to permit people to cross from one track to another. I was convinced that the bridge had been provided to lend an exotic touch and to make the station premises a place of pleasant diversity, like some foreign playground. I remained under this delusion for quite a long time, and it was for me a very refined amusement indeed to climb up and down the bridge. I thought that it was one of the most elegant services provided by the railways. When later I discovered that the bridge was nothing more than a utilitarian device, I lost all interest in it. Again, when as a child I saw photographs of subway trains in picture books, it never occurred to me that they had been invented out of practical necessity. I could only suppose that riding underground instead of on the surface must be a novel and delightful pastime. I have been sickly ever since I was a child, and have frequently been confined to bed. How often as I lay there I used to think what uninspired decorations sheets and pillowcases make. It wasn't until I was about 20 that I realized that they actually served a practical purpose, and this revelation of human dullness stirred dark depression in me. Again, I have never known what it means to be hungry. I don't mean by this statement that I was raised in a well-to-do family. I have no such banal intent. I mean that I have had not the remotest idea of the nature of the sensation of hunger. It sounds peculiar to say it, but I have never been aware that my stomach was empty. When as a boy I returned home from school, the people at home would make a great fuss over me. "You must be hungry. We remember what it's like, how terribly hungry you feel by the time you get home from school. How about some jelly beans? There's cake and biscuits, too." Seeking to please, as I invariably did, I would mumble that I was hungry and stuff a dozen jelly beans in my mouth. But what they meant by feeling hungry completely escaped me. Of course, I do eat a great deal all the same, but I have almost no recollection of ever having done so out of hunger. Unusual or extravagant things tempt me, and when I go to the house of somebody else, I eat almost everything put before me, even if it takes some effort. As a child, the most painful part of the day was unquestionably mealtime, especially in my own home. At my house in the country, the whole family, we were about 10 in number, ate together, lined up in two facing rows at table. Being the youngest child, I naturally sat at the end. The dining room was dark, and the sight of the 10 or more members of the household eating their lunch, or whatever the meal was, in gloomy silence, was enough to send chills through me. Besides, this was an old-fashioned country household, where the food was more or less prescribed, and it was useless even to hope for unusual or extravagant dishes. I dreaded mealtime more each day. I would sit there at the end of the table in the dimly lit room and, trembling all over as with the cold, I would lift a few morsels of food to my mouth and push them in. Why must human beings eat three meals every single day? What extraordinarily solemn faces they all make as they eat. It seems to be some kind of ritual. Three times every day at the regulated hour the family gathers in this gloomy room. The places are all laid out in the proper order and, regardless of whether we're hungry or not, we munch our food in silence, with lowered eyes. Who knows? It may be an act of prayer to propitiate whatever spirits may be lurking around the house. At times I went so far as to think in such terms. "Eat or die," the saying goes, but to my ears, it sounded like just one more unpleasant threat. Nevertheless, this superstition, I could only think of it as such, always aroused doubt and fear in me. Nothing was so hard for me to understand, so baffling, and at the same time, so filled with menacing overtones as the commonplace remark, "Human beings work to earn their bread, for if they don't eat, they die." In other words, you might say that I still have no understanding of what makes human beings tick. My apprehension on discovering that my concept of happiness seemed to be completely at variance with that of everyone else was so great as to make me toss sleeplessly and groan night after night in my bed. It drove me indeed to the brink of lunacy. I wonder if I have actually been happy. People have told me, really more times than I can remember, ever since I was a small boy, how lucky I was. But I have always felt as if I were suffering in hell. It has seemed to me, in fact, that those who called me lucky were incomparably more fortunate than I. I have sometimes thought that I have been burdened with a pack of 10 misfortunes, any one of which, if borne by my neighbor, would be enough to make a murderer of him. I simply don't understand. I have not the remotest clue what the nature or extent of my neighbor's woes can be. Practical troubles, griefs that can be assuaged if only there is enough to eat. These may be the most intense of all burning hells, horrible enough to blast to smithereens my 10 misfortunes. But that is precisely what I don't understand. If my neighbors manage to survive without killing themselves, without going mad, maintaining an interest in political parties, not yielding to despair, resolutely pursuing the fight for existence, can their griefs really be genuine? Am I wrong in thinking that these people have become such complete egoists and are so convinced of the normality of their way of life that they have never once doubted themselves? If that is the case, their suffering should be easy to bear. They are the common lot of human beings, and perhaps the best one can hope for. I don't know. If you've slept soundly at night, the morning is exhilarating, I suppose. What kind of dreams do they have? What do they think about when they walk along the street? Money? Hardly. It couldn't only be that. I seem to have heard the theory advanced that human beings live in order to eat. But I've never heard anyone say that they lived in order to make money. No. And yet, in some instances, no, I don't even know that. The more I think of it, the less I understand. All I feel are the assaults of apprehension and terror at the thought that I am the only one who is entirely unlike the rest. It is almost impossible for me to converse with other people. What should I talk about? How should I say it? I don't know. This was how I happened to invent my clowning. It was the last quest for love I was to direct at human beings. Although I had a mortal dread of human beings, I seemed quite unable to renounce their society. I managed to maintain on the surface a smile which never deserted my lips. This was the accommodation I offered to others, a most precarious achievement performed by me only at the cost of excruciating efforts within. As a child, I had absolutely no notion of what others, even members of my own family, might be suffering or what they were thinking. I was aware only of my own unspeakable fears and embarrassments. Before anyone realized it, I had become an accomplished clown, a child who never spoke a single truthful word. I have noticed that in photographs of me taken about that time together with my family, the others all have serious faces. Only mine is invariably contorted into a peculiar smile. This was one more variety of my childish, pathetic antics. Again, I never once answered back anything said to me by my family. The least word of reproof struck me with the force of a thunderbolt and drove me almost out of my head. answer back. Far from it. I felt convinced that their reprimands were without doubt voices of human truth speaking to me from eternities past. I was obsessed with the idea that since I lacked the strength to act in accordance with this truth, I might already have been disqualified from living among human beings. This belief made me incapable of arguments or self-justification. Whenever anyone criticized me, I felt certain that I had been living under the most dreadful misapprehension. I always accepted the attack in silence, though inwardly so terrified as almost to be out of my mind. It is true, I suppose, that nobody finds it exactly pleasant to be criticized or shouted at, but I see in the face of the human being raging at me a wild animal in its true colors, one more horrible than any lion, crocodile, or dragon. People normally seem to be hiding this true nature, but an occasion will arise, as when an ox sedately ensconced in a grassy meadow suddenly lashes out with its tail to kill the horsefly on its flank, when anger makes them reveal in a flash human nature in all its horror. Seeing this happen has always induced in me a fear great enough to make my hair stand on end, and at the thought that this nature might be one of the prerequisites for survival as a human being, I have come close to despairing of myself. I have always shook with fright before human beings. Unable as I was to feel the least particle of confidence in my ability to speak and act like a human being, I kept my solitary agonies locked in my breast. I kept my melancholy and my agitation hidden, careful lest any trace should be left exposed. I feigned an innocent optimism. I gradually perfected myself in the role of the farcical eccentric. I thought, as long as I can make them laugh, it doesn't matter how, I'll be all right. If I succeed in that, the human beings probably won't mind it too much if I remain outside their lives. The one thing I must avoid is becoming offensive in their eyes. I shall be nothing, the wind, the sky. My activities as a jester, a role born of desperation, were extended even to the servants, whom I feared even more than my family because I found them incomprehensible. In the summer, I made everybody laugh by sauntering through the house wearing a red woolen sweater under my cotton kimono. Even my elder brother, who was rarely given to mirth, burst out laughing and commented in intolerably affectionate tones, "That doesn't look so good on you, Yozo." But for all my follies, I was not so insensitive to heat and cold as to walk around in a woolen sweater at the height of summer. I had pulled my little sister's leggings over my arms, letting just enough stick out at the opening of the sleeves to give the impression that I was wearing a sweater. My father frequently had business in Tokyo and maintained a townhouse for that reason. He spent 2 or 3 weeks of the month at a time in the city, always returning laden with a really staggering quantity of presents, not only for members of our immediate family, but even for our relatives. It was a kind of hobby on his part. Once, the night before he was to leave for Tokyo, he summoned all the children to the parlor and smilingly asked us what present we would like this time, carefully noting each child's reply in a little book. It was most unusual for Father to behave so affectionately with the children.
"How about you, Yozo?"
he asked, but I could only stammer uncertainly. Whenever I was asked what I wanted, my first impulse was to answer, "Nothing." The thought went through my mind that it didn't make any difference, that nothing was going to make me happy. At the same time, I was congenitally unable to refuse anything offered to me by another person, no matter how little it might suit my tastes. when I hated something. I could not pronounce the words, I don't like it. When I liked something, I tasted it hesitantly, furtively, as though it were extremely bitter. In either case, I was torn by unspeakable fear. In other words, I hadn't the strength even to choose between two alternatives. In this fact, I believe, lay one of the characteristics which in later years was to develop into a major cause of my life of shame. I remained silent, fidgeting. My father lost a little of his good humor.
Will it be a book for you? Or how about a mask for the New Year lion dance? They sell them now in children's sizes. Wouldn't you like one?
The fatal words, wouldn't you like one, made it quite impossible for me to answer. I couldn't even think of any suitably clownish response. The jester had completely failed. A book would be best, I suppose, my brother said seriously.
Oh?
The pleasure drained from my father's face. He snapped his notebook shut without writing anything. What a failure. Now I had angered my father, and I could be sure that his revenge would be something fearful. That night, as I lay shivering in bed, I tried to think if there was still not some way of redressing the situation. I crept out of bed, tiptoed down to the parlor, and opened the drawer of the desk where my father had most likely put his notebook. I found the book and took it out. I riffled through the pages until I came to the place where he had jotted down our requests for presents. I licked the notebook pencil and wrote in big letters, Lion Mask. This accomplished, I returned to my bed. I had not the faintest wish for a lion mask. In fact, I would actually have preferred a book. But it was obvious that Father wanted to buy me a mask. My frantic desire to cater to his wishes and restore his good humor had emboldened me to sneak into the parlor in the dead of night. This desperate expedient was rewarded by the great success I had hoped for. When, some days later, my father returned from Tokyo, I overheard him say to Mother in his loud voice, I was in the children's room at the time,
"What do you think I found when I opened my notebook in the toy shop? See? Somebody has written here, Lion Mask. It's not my handwriting. For a minute I couldn't figure it out. Then it came to me. This was some of Yozo's mischief. You know, I asked him what he wanted from Tokyo, but he just stood there grinning without saying a word. Later he must have got to wanting that Lion Mask so badly he couldn't stand it. He's certainly a funny kid. Pretends not to know what he wants, and then goes and writes it. If he wanted a mask so much, all he had to do was tell me. I burst out laughing in front of everybody in the toy shop. Ask him to come here at once.
On another occasion, I assembled all our men and women servants in the foreign-style room. I got one of the men servants to bang at random on the keys of the piano. Our house was well equipped with most amenities, even though we were in the country. And I made everyone roar with laughter by cavorting in a wild Indian dance to his hit-and-miss tune. My brother took a flashbulb photograph of me performing my dance. When the picture was developed, you could see my pee-pee through the opening between the two handkerchiefs, which served for a loincloth. And this too occasioned much merriment. It was perhaps to be accounted a triumph which surpassed my own expectations. I used to subscribe regularly to a dozen or more children's magazines, and for my private reading, ordered books of all sorts from Tokyo. I became an adept in the exploits of Dr. Nonsentius and Dr. Know-It-All, and was intimately acquainted with all manner of spooky stories, tales of adventure, collections of jokes, songs, and the like. I was never short of material for the absurd stories I solemnly related to make the members of my family laugh. But what of my schooling? I was well on the way to winning respect. But the idea of being respected used to intimidate me excessively. My definition of a respected man was one who had succeeded almost completely in hoodwinking people, but who was finally seen through by some omniscient, omnipotent person who ruined him and made him suffer a shame worse than death. Even supposing I could deceive most human beings into respecting me, one of them would know the truth, and sooner or later, other human beings would learn from him. What would be the wrath and vengeance of those who realized how they had been tricked? That was a hair-raising thought. I acquired my reputation at school less because I was the son of a rich family than because, in the vulgar parlance, I had brains. Being a sickly child, I often missed school for a month or two or even a whole school year at a stretch. Nevertheless, when I returned to school, still convalescent and in a rickshaw, and took the examinations at the end of the year, I was always first in my class, thanks to my brains. I never studied, even when I was well. During recitation time at school, I would draw cartoons, and in the recess periods, I made the other children in the class laugh with the explanations to my drawings. In the composition class, I wrote nothing but funny stories. My teacher admonished me, but that didn't make me stop, for I knew that he secretly enjoyed my stories. One day, I submitted a story written in a particularly doleful style, recounting how when I was taken by my mother on the train to Tokyo, I had made water in a spittoon in the corridor. But at the time, I had not been ignorant that it was a spittoon. I deliberately made my blunder, pretending a childish innocence. I was so sure that the teacher would laugh that I stealthily followed him to the staff room. As soon as he left the classroom, the teacher pulled out my composition from the stack written by my classmates. He began to read as he walked down the hall and was soon snickering. He went into the staff room, and a minute or so later, was it when he finished it? He burst into loud guffaws, his face scarlet with laughter. I watched him press my paper on the other teachers. I felt very pleased with myself. A mischievous little imp. I had succeeded in appearing mischievous. I had succeeded in escaping from being respected. My report card was all A's except for deportment, where it was never better than a C or a D. This, too, was a source of great amusement to my family. My true nature, however, was one diametrically opposed to the role of a mischievous imp. Already by that time, I had been taught a lamentable thing by the maids and men servants. I was being corrupted. I now think that to perpetrate such a thing on a small child is the ugliest, vilest, cruelest crime a human being can commit. But I endured it. I even felt as if it enabled me to see one more particular aspect of human beings. I smiled in my weakness. If I had formed the habit of telling the truth, I might perhaps have been able to confide unabashedly to my father or mother about the crime. But I could not fully understand even my own parents. To appeal for help to any human being, I could expect nothing from that expedient. Supposing I complained to my father or my mother, or to the police, the government, I wondered if in the end I would not be argued into silence by someone in good graces with the world, by the excuses of which the world approved. It is only too obvious that favoritism inevitably exists. It would have been useless to complain to human beings. So I said nothing of the truth. I felt I had no choice but to endure whatever came my way and go on playing the clown.
Some, perhaps, will deride me. What do you mean by not having faith in human beings? When did you become a Christian anyway? I fail to see, however, that a distrust for human beings should necessarily lead directly to religion. Is it not true, rather, that human beings, including those who may now be deriding me, are living in mutual distrust, giving not a thought to God or anything else? There was something that happened when I was a small boy. A celebrated figure of the political party to which my father belonged had come to deliver a speech in our town, and I had been taken by the servants to the theater to hear him. The house was packed. Everybody in town who was especially friendly to my father was present and enthusiastically applauding. When the speech was over, the audience filtered out in threes and fives into the night. As they set out for home on the snow-covered roads, they were scathingly commenting on the meeting. I could distinguish among the voices those of my father's closest friends, complaining in tones almost of anger about how inept my father's opening remarks had been, and how difficult it was to make head or tail out of the great man's address. Then, these men stopped by my house, went into our parlor, and told my father, with expressions of genuine delight on their faces, what a great success the meeting had been. Even the servants, when asked by my mother about the meeting, answered as if it were their spontaneous thought that it had been really interesting. These were the self-same servants who had been bitterly complaining on the way home that political meetings are the most boring thing in the world. This, however, is only a minor example. I am convinced that human life is filled with many pure, happy, serene examples of insincerity, truly splendid of their kind, of people deceiving one another without, strangely enough, any wounds being inflicted, of people who seem unaware even that they are deceiving one another. But I have no special interest in instances of mutual deception. I myself spent the whole day long deceiving human beings with my clowning. I have not been able to work up much concern over the morality prescribed in textbooks of ethics under such names as righteousness. I find it difficult to understand the kind of human being who lives, or who is sure he can live, purely, happily, serenely, while engaged in deceit. Human beings never did teach me that abstruse secret. If I had only known that one thing, I should never have had to dread human beings so, nor should I have opposed myself to human life, nor tasted such torments of hell every night. In short, I believe that the reason why I did not tell anyone about that loathsome crime perpetrated on me by the servants was not because of distrust for human beings, nor, of course, because of Christian leanings, but because the human beings around me had rigorously sealed me off from the world of trust or distrust. Even my parents at times displayed attitudes which were hard for me to understand. I also have the impression that many women have been able, instinctively, to sniff out this loneliness of mine, which I confided to no one. And this in later years was to become one of the causes of my being taken advantage of in so many ways. Women found in me a man who could keep a love secret. The Second Notebook. On the shore, at a point so close to the ocean, one might imagine it was there that the waves broke, stood a row of over 20 fairly tall cherry trees, with coal-black trunks. Every April, when the new school year was about to begin, these trees would display their dazzling blossoms and their moist brown leaves against the blue of the sea. Soon, a snowstorm of blossoms would scatter innumerable petals into the water, flecking the surface with points of white which the waves carried back to the shore. This beach, strewn with cherry blossoms, served as the playground of the high school I attended. Stylized cherry blossoms flowered even on the badge of the regulation school cap
and on the buttons of our uniforms. A distant relative of mine had a house nearby, which was one reason why my father had especially selected me for this school of cherry blossoms by the sea. I was left in the care of the family, whose house was so close to the school that even after the morning bell had rung, I could still make it to my class in time if I ran. That was the kind of lazy student I was. But I nevertheless managed, thanks to my accustomed antics, to win popularity with my schoolmates. This was my first experience living in a strange town. I found it far more agreeable than my native place. One might attribute this, perhaps, to the fact that my clowning had, by this time, become so much a part of me that it was no longer such a strain to trick others. I wonder, though, if it was not due instead to the incontestable difference in the problem involved in performing before one's own family and strangers, or in one's own town and elsewhere. This problem exists no matter how great a genius one may be. An actor dreads most the audience in his hometown. I imagine the greatest actor in the world would be quite paralyzed in a room where all his family and relatives were gathered to watch him. But I had learned to play my part. I had moreover been quite a success. It was inconceivable that so talented an actor would fail away from home. The fear of human beings continued to writhe in my breast. I am not sure whether more or less intensely than before, but my acting talents had unquestionably matured. I could always convulse the classroom with laughter, and even as the teacher protested what a good class it would be if only I were not in it, he would be laughing behind his hand. At a word from me, even the military drill instructor, whose more usual idiom was a barbarous, thunderous roar, would burst into helpless laughter. Just when I had begun to relax my guard a bit, fairly confident that I had succeeded by now in concealing completely my true identity, I was stabbed in the back quite unexpectedly. The assailant, like most people who stab in the back, bordered on being a simpleton, the puniest boy in the class, whose scrofulous face and floppy jacket with sleeves too long for him was complemented by a total lack of proficiency in his studies and by such clumsiness in military drill and physical training that he was perpetually designated as an onlooker. Not surprisingly, I failed to recognize the need to be on my guard against him. That day, Takeichi, that was the boy's name, as I recall, was as usual onlooking during the physical training period while the rest of us drilled on the horizontal bar. Deliberately assuming as solemn a face as I could muster, I lunged overhead at the bar, shouting with the effort. I missed the bar and sailed on as if I were making a broad jump, landing with a thud in the sand on the seat of my pants. This failure was entirely premeditated, but everybody burst out laughing, exactly as I had planned. I got to my feet with a rueful smile and was brushing the sand from my pants when Takeichi, who had crept up from somewhere behind, poked me in the back. He murmured, "You did it on purpose." I trembled all over. I might have guessed that someone would detect that I had deliberately missed the bar, but that Takeichi should have been the one came as a bolt from the blue. I felt as if I had seen the world before me burst in an instant into the raging flames of hell. It was all I could do to suppress a wild shriek of terror. The ensuing days were imprinted with my anxiety and dread. I continued on the surface making everybody laugh with my miserable clowning, but now and then painful sighs escaped my lips. Whatever I did, Takeichi would see through it, and I was sure he would soon start spreading the word to everyone he saw. At this thought, my forehead broke out in a sweat. I stared around me vacantly with the wild eyes of a madman. If it were possible, I felt, I would like to keep a 24-hours-a-day surveillance over Takeichi, never stirring from him, morning, noon, or night, to make sure that he did not divulge the secret. I brooded over what I should do. I would devote the hours spent with him to persuading him that my antics were not on purpose, but the genuine article. If things went well, I would like to become his inseparable friend. But if this proved utterly impossible, I had no choice but to pray for his death. Typically enough, the one thing that never occurred to me was to kill him. During the course of my life, I have wished innumerable times that I might meet with a violent death, but I have never once desired to kill anybody. I thought that in killing a dreaded adversary, I might actually be bringing him happiness. In order to win over Takeichi, I clothed my face in the gentle beguiling smile of the false Christian. I strolled everywhere with him, my arm lightly around his scrawny shoulders, my head tilted affectionately towards him. I frequently would invite him in honeyed, cajoling tones to come and play in the house where I was lodging. But instead of an answer, he always gave me only blank stares in return. One day, after school was let out, it must have been in the early summer, there was a sudden downpour. The other students were making a great fuss about getting back to their lodgings, but since I lived just around the corner, I decided to make a dash for it. Just as I was about to rush outside, I noticed Takeichi hovering dejectedly in the entranceway. I said, "Let's go. I'll lend you my umbrella." I grabbed Takeichi's hand as he hesitated and ran out with him into the rain. When we arrived home, I asked my aunt to dry our jackets. I had succeeded in luring Takeichi to my room. The household consisted of my aunt, a woman in her 50s, and my two cousins, the older of whom was a tall, frail, bespectacled girl of about 30. She had been married at one time, but was later separated. And the younger, a short, round-faced girl who looked fresh out of high school. The ground floor of the house was given over to a shop where small quantities of stationery supplies and sporting goods were offered for sale. But the principal source of income was the rent from the 5 or 6 tenements built by my late uncle. Takeichi, standing haplessly in my room, said, "My ears hurt." They must have got wet in the rain. I examined his ears and discovered they were both running horribly. The lobes seemed filled to the bursting with pus. I simulated an exaggerated concern. "This looks terrible. It must hurt." Then, in the gentle tones a woman might use, I apologized. "I'm so sorry I dragged you out in all this rain." I went downstairs to fetch some cotton wool and alcohol. Takeichi lay on the floor with his head on my lap, and I painstakingly swabbed his ears. Even Takeichi seemed not to be aware of the hypocrisy, the scheming behind my actions. Far from it. His comment as he lay there with his head pillowed in my lap was, "I'll bet lots of women will fall for you." It was his illiterate approximation of a compliment. This, I was to learn in later years, was a kind of demoniacal prophecy, more horrible than Takeichi could have realized. To fall for. To be fallen for. I feel in these words something unspeakably vulgar, farcical, and at the same time, extraordinarily complacent. Once these expressions, put in an appearance, no matter how solemn the place, the silent cathedrals of melancholy crumble, leaving nothing but an impression of fatuousness. It is curious, but the cathedrals of melancholy are not necessarily demolished. If one can replace the vulgar, "What a messy business it is to be fallen for," by the more literary, What an easiness lies in being loved.
Takeichi uttered that idiotic compliment, that women would fall for me, because I had been kind enough to clean